Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Without a doubt, one of the big sensations of 2015 was the musical Hamilton, which opened just about a year ago. I first heard about the show from my colleague Rebecca Mead a long time before that, who was writing a profile of its creator, Lin-Manuel Miranda. You can sum up Hamilton by saying it's a hip-hop musical based on the life of Alexander Hamilton in which all the founding fathers and mothers are played by actors of color rapping. But that might sound gimmicky, and this show is anything but. It's got a real vision of America, and it takes our history very seriously. It actually takes as its inspiration Ron Chernow's authoritative biography of Alexander Hamilton. Lin-Manuel Miranda wrote the music, the lyrics, and the book, and he stars as Hamilton. He spoke with Rebecca Mead at the New Yorker Festival this fall, and what you'll hear right at the top is a video of the cast doing the big number, My Shot.
Here we go.
I'm past patiently waiting, I'm passionately smashing every expectation, every action's an act of creation. I'm laughing in the face of casualties of sorrow. For the first time I'm thinking past tomorrow.
When I am not going to play my shot, I am not going to play my shot. And you will just like my country, I'm not scrappy and hungry, and I'm not going to play my shot. We gonna rise up, it's time to take a shot. We gonna rise up, it's time to take a shot. We gonna rise up.
Oh, that looks good.
It looks really good on a big screen,
yeah,
doesn't it?
It does.
So the first time I saw any performance of Hamilton was in a workshop production in the spring of last year.
That was a heavy, heavy... Yeah, that was the first time we'd staged Act One, the first time we'd tried the costumes.
Hmm. When did you first see it?
When did I first see the show?
When did you first see the show? When was it?
I first saw the show with the public.
So how was that? What did you see?
I burst into tears at the end of the opening number. there are things you can't possibly see from on stage, and I always preface my notes to the creative team when we were working on the show. I said, these are notes from the lobster inside the boiling pot. I have no perspective at all. But what killed me was at the end of the opening number, Alexander Hamilton is the only one looking out and everyone else has their heads bowed in prayer. And it just killed me. It's telling you that they're all going to be narrating the story. They're going to be shifting their roles as storytellers over the course of the night. And they know the ending, and Hamilton doesn't know yet. So it's just moving on a very profound level. And then, you know, kept on crying from there.
When you're in it, do you have moments that are particular high points for you in performance? Does it change?
It changes. It changes every night. And now that we're settled into a long run, the audience is just as much a part of it for me. We have a front row of people who have won tickets for $10. So their energy is amazing. And I can see faces 14 rows back. So I keep track of what you're feeling. I keep track of, the lady in the third row who's asleep but woke up in time for Dear Theodosia. And you know what? I'll take a sleeping audience member over a texting audience member any day of the week. I don't know your life. I've fallen asleep at great shows. This is the first time I sat down all day. I'll keep track of her. I'll keep track of the two kids over here who I can tell got the cast album because they're starting to sing along. And that's starting to be a part of the process. But I'm keeping tabs on all of it. In terms of what's fun to perform, I was a very... My parents worked a lot. I was a very self-entertained childhood. I think most artists grow up in a world of sort of benign neglect. You have to be left to your own devices enough to make it up. And when we were rehearsing Take a Break, which is a song in Act Two, where Eliza and Angelica are trying to get Alexander to go upstate and stay at the Schuyler mansion and take a break from all his political troubles. Tommy says to me in rehearsal, he said, I can just picture 7-year-old friendless Lynn being like, sorry, ladies, I can't make out with you. I work for the president and I got to go have an affair with this hot lady over here. There's lots of moments like that where it's like I'm holding a sword and shooting a gun and it's 7-year-old Lynn wish fulfillment. On a very real scale. And then there's the parts where I just kind of get to glory in the performances of my teammates. I mean, my rap battles with David Diggs are the most fun I have on stage because they're written and I win them. But also, he brings something new every time, even if it's physical or tiny or he makes a comment. If I make a comment on something and someone makes a reaction in the audience, he looks at them and kind of goes, oh, I saw that. I'm always on my toes. So the joy of these collaborators and this murderer's row of actors keeps it fresh pretty much every night.
One of the things that is so, so striking about the show is, of course, the way that you've cast almost all of the principals, save King George III, are actors of color.
Yeah.
And... And it has this tremendous theatrical effect of saying without explicitly saying, you know, this story is ours too.
Yeah.
When did you decide that that was something you were going to do? Was that a decision you made early on before you'd even started casting in your head? Or was it something you just started casting, oh, there's Chris, is this, and David is this, and then you realized what you were doing?
I would love to tell you there was a bold... political pronouncement.
Uh-huh.
We're going to change. There wasn't. Honestly, it has its roots in the fact that I did conceive of this as a concept album first. So even in my first read-through of Ron's book, I was casting in terms of voices. I wasn't picturing the people on Money when I was reading the book the first time through because reading it as Hamilton's story made me see it as a hip-hop story. And so when I read the name Hercules Mulligan, I just thought, well, Busta Rhymes plays Hercules Mulligan. That's the best rapper name I ever heard that isn't actually a rapper name. Hercules Mulligan. And, you know, when I got to the part where the corrupt governor of New York is named George Clinton, and I thought, oh, there's going to be a P-Funk rap battle, and on the cast album it'll say introducing George Clinton as himself. These were all bold but these were all ideas in my head as I was reading the book for the first time. So it was never a question. It was who are the best people to sing these songs, which are hip-hop and R&B songs. And Chris Jackson was really George Washington since In the Heights. I don't know of an actor, maybe James Earl Jones, who has more moral authority on stage. That's just what he has. So, you know, it's this mix of actors we knew about writing to their strengths and then writing to these characters. And the fun of this is determining what do our founding fathers sound like and what do our founding mothers sound like. In writing Angelica Schuyler, I decided she's actually the smartest character in the show. So she has the most complicated and intricate raps, but she also sings these arias because her brain just literally works faster than everybody else's. She meets Hamilton, who is this whirlwind and dynamo, and she reads him. She reads him in a second. She goes, I know what this guy's after. I can't give it to him. I love him. My sister can be with him, and just reads the whole thing and then slows down the action to explain her thought process to us. And when Renee Elise Goldsberry walked in the room, it was the first actress who, that's actually the speed at which she speaks. It was the first person where it wasn't, she didn't deliver the music like, look how hard I'm working. She delivered it as if this is just the speed at which I speak and I trust you to catch up. And it's really thrilling to watch.
As I'm sure everybody here knows, Billboard magazine called it the best rap album of 2015.
Yeah.
Pretty crazy. And I just like to say thank you for proving that the best rap album of the year can. You can have a whole rap album and not have the word bitch in it. So thank you very much for that. You talked about having to cut a line here and there. You also had to cut entire bits in the process, and not just from the public to Broadway, but earlier on. Was there anything that you just, you really hate that you had to cut and you just...
Oh, I don't hate that I had to cut any of it, honestly, because, you know, it exists. It doesn't go. And it's not like I hit empty trash on my computer and it's gone forever. It exists. There was a whole third rap battle about the issue of slavery that didn't make it into the final thing because frankly, none of them did anything about slavery. Even Hamilton, who was an abolitionist and got the importation of slaves banned in New York through the Manumission Society, he didn't put it above his financial plan. There was a moment where two Quakers from Pennsylvania introduced a House motion to ban importation of slaves. And it was on the House floor. Actually, Joseph Ellis writes really eloquently about it in either Founding Brothers or one of his other books. Madison let it be on the House for the day, and they talked about slavery for 3 days. And then he passed a motion because he was the majority and he made shit happen. They called him the scalpel. He passed a law saying, we're not going to discuss this until 1808. So they literally kicked the ball down the field for future generations. They said, we don't know what to do, and we're not going to solve it. But I wrote a rap battle about this as if it were happening in Washington's private quarters. And it's Jefferson saying, you know, the Constitution clearly states that the states have to wait until 1808 to debate on whether to ban the slave trade. And whether you like it or not, that is the compromise we made. Wait. And, you know, Hamilton's trying to jump in. And they get into it. And he says, so let's say we cure prejudice. Like, do we send them back to Africa? Do we designate a state? Like, what's the solution? And then Hamilton throws Sally Hemings in his face. And then Madison was like, oh, are we talking about extramarital affairs? Do you want to have that conversation? And then Hamilton shuts up. And then Washington says, we're not going to say anything. And it was enormously cathartic to write it. Uh-huh. Because this was something, obviously, you wrestle with when you write about these men who wrote great things and also had this other legacy, lived within this system that was horrible and abusive. And it just brought the show to a screeching halt. Mm-hmm. It just, you know, and this is a show that really thrives on momentum because it's sung through. So we're going to put that out. We're making another mixtape, and I'm going to put out the demo so that you can hear it. But it didn't work within the context of the show. So that one hurt because it was really cathartic to write. People miss the Whiskey Rebellion. The Whiskey Rebellion existed at the Public within Washington's farewell song. And it's fun to see Washington and Hamilton go from rebels to putting down a rebellion. And it was them going, you know, you are outgunned, outmanned. And Hamilton in the back going, pay your f***ing taxes. It was a nice little moment. But it ultimately sort of muddied up the really audacious act, which is Washington stepping down after 2 terms and creating the precedent of a 2-term presidency. And we really wanted to focus on that.
I know when you were rehearsing, I was watching you and Chris rehearsing that scene of Washington's farewell address when you break into the words of Washington. And I remember you saying, God, I just feel really patriotic after reading this. I mean, has working on this show made you feel differently about America, made you feel differently connected to your country?
Yes.
My country too, by the way.
Yes.
I'm an immigrant. We get job.
The job. Yeah, you do. Applause for writer Rebecca Mead. Isn't it nice? Isn't it so much better than sitting alone? What good is sitting alone in your room? Yes. Honestly, I think the secret sauce in the score of Hamilton is my enthusiasm in learning all of this for the first time. I knew the basic facts, but I did not know about the inner lives of these characters. I did not know about their home lives. I had to learn all that stuff to write it. And the fact that you could take the rap battles of our show, put them in the mouths of different talking heads and put them on MSNBC tomorrow and they would be just as relevant gives me hope. It's heartening to me to know that the this was never a perfect union. It's always been striving for a more perfect union. And the beefs between Hamilton and Jefferson are the beefs we're always going to have. We're always going to push for too much government power, and then we're going to push back against it. We're always going to go too far in helping another country, and then we're going to go, oh, we got to take care of what's going on at home. Those are the rap battles that we have in our show. How much do we get involved in the affairs of other states? How much does our government have over our lives? And how much are they allowed to tax us, and how much are they not? We're always going to be fighting about these things. That gives me comfort. It doesn't, and frankly, the fact, because, you know, people say, this is the worst, you know, go on TV, you know, they get ratings by telling you how apocalyptic the situation is. Yeah, Jefferson called John Adams a hermaphrodite in the election of 1800. John Adams countered by saying, Jefferson died, you should vote for me. Counting on word traveling slow, because it's 1800. Jefferson died. You should vote for me. By the time Jefferson, you know, makes sure that everyone knows he's alive, it'll be too late and they'll have voted for me. That's dirty politics. So, you know, don't tell me that it's worse than it's ever been, because it was always bad.
But here we are in another election cycle, and the show is relevant on an entirely other level, and even from the public to the to Broadway, there's a little change here or there that amplifies that the message about immigration. And there's now the point where Hamilton's foes tell him to go on back home to where he came from.
Right.
What do you think about this rhetoric that's going on about immigration in this current?
It's so old. Planet? It's so old. This isn't new. That the one thing that writing the show has given me is real perspective. Pat Buchanan was singing this song in 1996. He did "The Mexicans Are Coming to Kill Us All," that famous chorus. It is an old song, and we've heard it. And there's always going to be a politician there to grab that fervor, whether it's when it's felt in public sentiment, and run with it and make a stab at it. That's about all I can say about it. It's a part of our politics, just like anything else's.
Well, that's, I'm afraid, all we have time for, but thank you, Lin-Manuel Miranda. And thank you, everybody, for being here. Thank you.
Lin-Manuel Miranda, the creator and star of Hamilton, talking with The New Yorker's Rebecca Mead at the New Yorker Festival.